Hey everybody, this is the Uprising Review Podcast. My name is Everett. I am here with Steven, as always, my co-host and co-editor at the Uprising Review. You can check us out at uprisingreview.com if you're new to the podcast. If you're not, hey, we appreciate you guys sticking around. So today, we don't have a lot to talk about in terms of news or anything like that. We do have some new stories up on the website. Not a lot going on. We're trying to get, we're trying to get some new blood into op-eds is what we're kind of doing. I'm actually talking to one of my cousins right now about, she's a therapist who specializes in working with creative people. And so I'm talking to her about writing some things for us. But, today we have a special guest. He has written for us before. He's written op-eds. He's written, articles for us. His name is Mars Dorian. Mars, say hi to everybody.
Well, hello everyone. I just traveled here all the way from planet Mars, so I hope the stay is worthwhile.
Well, we're going to try to make it worthwhile. I have to know, is Mars your actual given name, or is that like a pen name?
It is actually a nickname. The name is Marius, or Marius Dorian. And, when I lived in the States, people had a big problem just pronouncing it. And what I did was basically, because I was a huge fan of the Red Planet and I liked the God of War, so I said, you know what, if you take out the I and the U, you actually have Mars. And that stuck ever since.
Oh, okay, that's pretty cool. I did not know that. But you're a writer, but you also do a lot of business stuff. Tell us a little bit about what you kind of do, because Steven and I have talked about, and Steven I know is a big fan of some of the websites you've consulted on, because Steven is really into marketing. So, just tell us a little bit about that. What kind of work do you do like that?
Yeah, so actually I do. It's not really business consulting. I started out basically as a blogger who used like illustrations and designs basically to promote my work online. And I have more a background like in comic creation and cartooning. And yeah, I just, I realized that the market in Germany wasn't great back then. And because my English was pretty decent and I had a lot of friends in the States and Canada and so on, I thought, you know what, I should just create like an English website and then promote my services. And then, with a lot of blogging and networking, showing images, I basically built my illustration design career. So what I always did was creating illustrations for book covers or for websites, like, let's say, the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where I did his web design in terms of the illustration, the background images and stuff like that. And yeah, and after some years of doing that and really enjoying like blog article writing, I just thought, you know what, I want to tell more stories, not just draw and illustrate, but really like tell my own stories. And a bunch of my bloggers that I befriended transitioned to self-publishing. So I started doing that as well like 3 years ago. And now it's like, I would say 50% of my income.
Oh, that is great. I always love hearing that, writers are making a decent living or making a decent sum of money off of their self-published work, because I'm a big advocate of self-publishing. And I really, or at least of small presses and self-publishing, I really feel strongly that we should encourage people to do it more. Because, hey, the more great work out there, the more I can read.
I was just going to say, I know I've mentioned this to you in kind of other correspondence, but I really, Fluent in 3 Months is an amazing site for just like the marketing in general. It's phenomenal, which you and you worked on, so.
Yeah, I had, I helped him. He was actually Benny, right? Yeah. He came to Berlin, and that was like years ago, and he needed some help with like branding advice and stuff like that. And later on, I actually wrote an article about Japanese learning, because I learned Japanese in a fairly short amount of time. And I also featured that article. But before that, we did some consulting together, which was pretty cool. That's what I love the internet for. Like, you meet the craziest people, like in a positive sense. And the opportunities and the relationships that are going to be created, there's so much potential, and I love that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just how we met you was kind of random. I mean, you, like, it was just our first, I think it was our first short story we published by John Della Rose. You just, left a comment on it, and I ended up finding your blog, and I ended up asking you for an op-ed, and it was an amazing op-ed. It's still, probably my favorite op-ed still. that we've done so far.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. It was great. Hey, just real quick, I want to touch on that op-ed. So if you guys listening are unfamiliar with Mars's op-ed for us, he has a really unique story. So, you know, put this on pause, go to uprisingview.com, look for Mars Dorian's op-ed, and then come back and put it on play. Okay, so now you're back. Great. Mars, tell us a little bit about your background. Your parents, from your op-ed, your parents were actually born, as you said, on the wrong side of the Berlin Wall. Tell us a little bit about what was it like? You know, you grew up in West Germany, though. So tell us a little bit, what was it like growing up in Germany during the Cold War?
Yeah, so my entire family was born in the east, east of Germany, which was ruled by the Soviets. And they were basically raised in that regime, that I guess a socialist regime, where life was pretty different from the Western capitalist American and ally sector. And so, you know, like, even though I was born in the West because they left the East, just their life and the way society impacted them has really like dramatically influenced my upbringing. Because it's just, you know, like if your parents were born and raised like in a regime, they have just a very different outlook on life. It was almost like they were immigrants, even though it's the same country, but they always felt like immigrants, right? And they had a deep distrust of the state, because back in the East, the state owned everything, right? That's what a lot of people don't know. Like, there was no private business. Every supermarket, every little store, every single thing was owned by the state, which meant it was controlled and supervised by the state. So whenever you said anything wrong about the state, when you were criticizing too much, like, the state was onto you, right? They were sending the police force. They had a lot of spies, like most of your friends, like, you know, some people say like up to 20% of all the people were working for the government involuntarily. And so just picture living in a society where you have to watch your every single word because one of your best friends might work for the government and you don't know it.
Yeah, that's something Mars and I were just talking about before we started recording the podcast. Mars and I actually love pretty much the same movie, which is called, if you've never seen this, it is called The Lives of Others. And it was, I forget the name of the director, but it's a great movie, a great German movie. He's seen it many times. I've seen it. If you guys are listening and you haven't seen it, go watch it because it is that good.
I really love that movie. The director is Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, which is actually a very old aristocratic name. And I know it was quite a pain to get that movie funded and took him almost 4 or 5 years and everything. But yeah, it basically shows like the life of someone spying on like an artistic couple. And he's basically, you know, like the entire room of that artistic couple is bugged. And he's sitting like in a special surveillance room. The guy, and he's working for the government, and he has to ensure if the people are actually like pro or against the state and if they're planning to flee and stuff like that. But over the time of that movie, when he gets to know them and their problems and their artistic ventures, he actually gets, you know, like he's feeling sympathy for them, and he's actually then turning to their side. And that, I don't want to spoil anything, but it has a very interesting showdown.
Yes, it does. I love watching like German films and Czech films and Polish films, things like that. I really, because I am kind of a historian a little bit, or at least I've trained in it. And one of the things I'm really interested in is the Soviet Union. Have you, Mars, ever seen a movie called The Tunnel, which is about a swimmer who tries to escape from the East into the West by digging underneath the Berlin Wall?
I've heard of it. Is it like two TV movies?
No, it's like a regular 2-hour movie. It's okay. two and a half hours, something like that. But it's a true story. Okay. About this swimmer, and his family had to defect. And it's such a cool ending, and it's such a cool story. I thought maybe you'd seen it have you seen Goodbye Lenin? I also love that movie.
Oh yeah, I saw that movie so many times. I actually love that movie. It's actually where some of my friends live near the area.
Okay, yeah. If you guys haven't seen these movies that we're talking about, I highly recommend them. They're absolutely worth the investment of tracking them down. And you could probably watch them on YouTube, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll link to them in the description. on the site. But so, yeah, I know kind of back to your op-ed a little bit here. Your parents were artists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so so
my mother.
Yeah, go ahead.
So my mother was into like fine art painting, and my father did more like I guess you call it graphic design, but was called something different back then. And yeah, they create like images and paintings and stuff like that. And the funny thing, or it's actually a sad thing, is that obviously when you're an artist, people they're used to criticizing things right through their art. So it was really a strange time for them to be there, because on one hand you got pretty decent training, and the training was pretty good actually, the studying. Because they did know how to do like drawing, and some schools were actually pretty good, even in the East. But as soon as you hit like the spot where you have an idea, right, or something that has to do about like ideology, or you have some kind of message in your art, then it becomes very tricky.
Yeah, the style of art they used was a Soviet socialist realism, right?
It's, well, the thing is, they had actually, like, in terms of, like, how you study art, like, in the East, they did all the basic knowledge, like, even from the Renaissance and stuff like that. So the actual training was pretty good. Like, people really know how to draw, like, anatomy and all that jazz. Like, that training was actually really, really good when it comes to just the style and the work of it. But, right, as soon as you venture in that territory, when you want to make a statement with your picture or your painting, or you have something that could be critical of the state, then like your teacher had to report on you if he wasn't working. Well, he was working for the government, because he was a teacher. So that was always like troublesome. So you had to keep quiet and just learn the ins and outs, but then you had to be very careful with what you were actually painting.
Yeah, that's something that I've heard. The ethics of Soviet socialist realism are a little bit unusual in that, like, if you guys haven't seen socialist realism, it is a very specific style of art, and it is basically ideologically driven art. And that's something that we talk a lot about at Uprising Review, is ideological art. So, like, how do you, whenever you're drawing or writing Mars, like, what is your process? Like, how do you get your ideas into a piece of art, and like, where do you start from?
Yeah, so because of their background, that has definitely impacted the way I see stories, right? That's why, like, freedom of expression is very dear to me. I really believe in the freedom of expression, that anything can be said. I don't say that it should be said, but it should be, like, you should be allowed to say whatever it is. And I always want to tell the stories. Like, basically all my stories, if it comes down to a theme, they have that theme about freedom of expression, individualism, right? Like the individual against like a big organization, whether that's like a big ass corporation or like most likely the like the state itself. And like I always have like that desire to like even when I draw characters or when I create characters with words, I always like create like some kind of like weird characters that have something about them that's quite different from the rest of how everyone else is. And they always have like a trouble like fitting in to some kind of hierarchy. And even when I draw like pictures, I have like a lot of words actually on their skin, right? So what I love to do is like using tweets or Facebook messages, and I put them on my characters. And you see like tweets and the hashtags like eyeliners, or like they have like tattoo tweets and stuff like that. And they have like clothing that does not exist in the real world, that's totally fake. And that would probably never work in real life, but that looks pretty good and basically supports the individualistic streak. So that's something that really impacts my art and my writing.
So one thing kind of on that similar note, we've definitely shared quite a few of your blog articles on the Uprising Review and on our social media and on my personal ones too. I love a lot of what you write about, especially, and I definitely recommend, especially for the writers out there, to go check out your blog at MarsDorian.com, because it's phenomenal. Just some of the advice you give. But one article that really And I know Ever and I talked about this in another podcast where we were kind of discussing his book covers and whatnot. But you had kind of realized after publishing a few of your space operas that you know, you realized you had to start better catering to that audience, to people who read space operas in your book covers.
Yes. It was like a revelation. Like, when I started out self-publishing, I had very comic-ish looking covers. Like, they actually, my friends or people in my network, when they saw my first book, which was called Blockbuster, I have put it off ever since because it has a lot of problems in terms of no good editing and stuff like that. But when I created the cover, it basically looked like a comic book, and needless to say, like, the book didn't sell much. Many copies. I think like I made like $50 in 3 months or something. It was a pathetic launch, but I was so inexperienced back then, and I just created like covers that I thought were cool without worrying about like the target audience. And ever since, I've learned so much from my friends, from my publishing friends, and from reading like countless articles. And I've now realized that there is a market demand, and you have to understand like your target audience and what appeals to them.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that would even, I mean, when you think about it, it definitely makes sense. But I think, you know, a lot of times when maybe someone sees your work, they're probably surprised by that simply because, yeah, your art is just really high quality. And so, but even so, you know, it's not just quality. It's about, you know, the market that you're trying to attract.
Yeah, and actually I want to say something as well, like, so I was catering to the market, but then my last space opera did okay-ish, but it was not as good as I expected it to go, and I thought it was, like, really well written, and then I thought, you know what, I don't want to just, like, cater to the like, I want to do something that's more my style. I love space opera, and I love, like, especially science fiction, but I did that for, like, I released, like, 3 books, and I wanted to do something different. And then when I create like the Crystal Crusade, which is more like about like a VR game world with RPG elements, I basically created like a cover that I really enjoyed because I'm a huge fan of Japanese video games. So when I created that cover, I really thought like, you know, this is what I want to create. Like, this is exactly the kind of cover that I love. It has that video game-ish feel. It has, I think, good colors and a good atmosphere. And that book is actually my most successful one yet. So, you know, like, this is the experience that I make, that on one hand you cater towards your target audience, but if you have the skill and you know what you like, that using that, it's really hard to put into words, right? But you create something that you think would appeal to you because you also like video games and RPGs, and then you understand your target audience, and if you find like the convergence, like, that can really work out well.
Yeah, it's kind of a fine balance, I guess.
Yes.
Go ahead, Stephen.
No, I was just going to ask. So because before the Crystal Crusade, you really were pretty much exclusively writing space operas. So what kind of made you decide to do something completely different?
Well, in the beginning, I actually published books that were more like, like, internet thriller-ish with, like, a blockbuster where, like, bloggers had so much power with their platforms that they were doing kind of like a Hunger Games form in terms of bloggers, right? Where they compete for the most views, and they became very desperate and did crazy things. And that was actually my first novel. But, like I said, like, I made very few sales, and I wrote another similar book like that. And I also had no professional editing. What I did, I had friends whom I exchanged services with, and they offered, and they were like freelance writers, so they offered to do like some editing. And then when I actually wanted to write like a space opera, I actually hired like a professional science fiction editor. And her work was so good that I realized, holy crap, like the first 2 books I published, like I cannot, like, it's just, I'm afraid to know like how many mistakes and things are wrong with it just because I didn't have a professional editor. So I put them off the market, right? That's what you can do with digital works. I just said, no, I think they need a lot of re-edits. So I put them off the market. So the books that I wrote after that were space opera, but I wrote different books before that. I just put them off. And then I realized, you know, like space opera is cool. It's trendy, but you can make good money with that. But I also have like artistic needs. And I want to do something different. And then I listened to some kind of writing podcast where they were talking about lit RPG, which basically is like a genre which is very new, which incorporates game elements into fiction, which is usually about like some people going into a very realistic role-playing game, mostly virtual reality, which works kind of like a traditional game. And then you write a story about that. And I listened to that podcast and I thought, holy crap, like that's really up my alley. I love video games. I still play them, probably too many. And I thought, like, I can write a cool story about that. And if there's any market out there that is interested in that, even better. And then I wrote that story that I really enjoyed, well, that was inspired by Final Fantasy. I created the cover and I released it and I did some marketing and it had a really good launch. And I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, you know, and it's a genre that, I mean, the first time I heard about it is when you were, you know, promoting the Mr. Crusade. And I'm really looking forward to read it. I just picked it up. I'm going to review it in the next month or so on StephenWills.co.
Cool.
But no, I'm really looking forward to finding out what a lit RPG is. I was actually looking it up, but I was like, no, I think I'm just going to read it and find out. So it should be fun.
Yeah, and I actually stopped calling it a lit RPG because I think that is a tag that actually confuses a lot of people. And I think the other problem is that a lot of people in that community, and it's becoming like a bigger community now, they have a very restricted view on what counts as lit RPG, right? If you don't have the right stat or if you don't have that trope, it doesn't really count. And I find that very, I don't know, that's annoying, right? Then sometimes you have people who say, that's not really lit RPG or you're not doing it right. So, you can get really bad reviews from some of those diehard fans who have a very limited viewpoint. So I just put off that label and like it's still obvious that it has that those game elements if you read the book description and stuff like that in the cover. But I just stay away from that label now.
So yeah, you mentioned that you get about half your income from writing now. And I'm assuming the other half of your income is like artistic design, graphic design, book covers, things like that.
Yes.
So like, what is your philosophy of design? What is your philosophy? How do you, when someone approaches you, if I approached you, because I have a book that I'm working on and hopefully it'll be out this fall. If I approached you and said, I have a book that I want a cover for, because yes, I've had some book cover problems. And I discussed that on another podcast. I won't go into it here unless we need to or something. But if you guys are interested, just listen to some of our other podcasts. I've talked about it before. But yeah, like what is your philosophy? What is your design philosophy? Like if I came to you and said, okay, here's this story that I have. It's set in Renaissance Italy. What can you do for a cover? What is your view on that?
Well, you know, like that view has changed over time because I do understand like the commercial aspects and they are important. So the first thing I would do is like ask you, first of all, what kind of book it is, right? Like what kind of genre you put it in, and then what kind of target audience you want to appeal to. So some people, they just write a book and they have no idea who it is for, right? And think, oh, yeah. And then you have that old trope where people say, I just want to write the best book possible and see what happens. And it, I mean, fair enough, right? But if you want to make money from it, like you should really know where to put it, right? What kind of label is it? Like, is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? And if it's fiction, what kind of genre is it? And then if you have that genre, is it like a specific type of that genre? So science fiction is like a basic genre. Then post-apocalyptic is a very specific sub niche. So is lit RPG nowadays or like space opera, right? And then I would, if I don't have any experience with that particular genre or subgenre, I would just do some research and then basically create a cover that both features basically what the book is about, right? Like the characters or even, or the emotion, the style, while also appeasing or like catering to that target audience to make sure that it will have like a financial appeal. Because it is important, right? People, if people are confused,
oh, yeah, it's absolutely important.
Yeah, and when we have and the cover is, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that a cover is the most important marketing aspect. Before you do any newsletters or social media or whatever, like your cover is your built-in marketing. And if you have really a crappy book cover, or you have a book cover that doesn't appeal like to your target audience because it's completely different, like you wanna, maybe you have like a really twisted and dark Mad Max style post-apocalyptic story, and then you have a very funky comic-ish book cover, I mean, that can confuse your audience, and that will lead to fewer sales.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That's something I learned because my book is, I designed the cover myself, and I thought, yeah, I'm not a bad artist. I'll just do my own cover. But I didn't think, who is this for? And it's also a problem I had whenever I was writing the book, because I just thought, I like historical fiction. I'm going to write historical fiction. My first book was about Japan, samurai in Japan. But I had a lot of trouble figuring out, okay, who is this for? And so from there, I developed a philosophy of a book for everyone is a book for no one. And that's really something that I believe. So when you're going to design a cover, you sit down with the author and say, okay, we need to talk about this from a marketing standpoint before we talk about it from an artistic standpoint, right?
Yeah, so that has obviously just happened over the past year or 2 years, because before that, I would just ask the client, okay, tell me more about your book and what are your ideas, and then would basically create a cover based on his or her ideas and what she wanted to have. But that has really changed now, because I realize, no, that's not like, you know, they're coming to you, not just because they want to have a nice cover, but because they want to sell their book. And as a cover designer, you're not just supposed to do something pretty. You're doing the packaging for like a commercial product, right? And if you want to self-publish, and I always ask them, like, what is your goal? If your goal is not to sell, like you just want to publish it for the heck of it, then you can have a really pretty cover and you can put on whatever you want. But as soon as you have like commercial interest, like you want to actually make good money from it, or you want to even like make a full-time living from self-publishing, then you got to think more commercial. It's just the way it is. And I enjoy that. I enjoy thinking about your target audience. I enjoy just understanding the market and the trends and all that jazz. Like, it's always like a mix, right? So you never want to just appeal 100%, because then your cover looks too samey and then it just doesn't stand out from the rest of the crowd. So you have to do something which is unique, but it also appeals to the target audience, so it's a nice mix.
And speaking of target audience, my favorite blog that you wrote, and I think it was the most recent one you put out, was on target audience. It was specifically on, you know, the genre, and the more niche you go, the better off you are, and the more the more people just be drawn to your book because, you know, I'll probably just let you explain it. You'll do a much better job than I will.
Yeah, so actually that idea came from, do you know Seth Godin?
No,
I don't.
Oh, wow. So he's like a big, unique marketer. He's very different. He's written a lot of interesting books. And basically all his books are about marketing, but he's not a classic marketing guy, like that corporate version that you see a lot of times. He's very unique. And he's from New York. And he basically has a very different idea of marketing. And he's very popular. He's given like a really good TED Talk. And he talks about basically like finding like your tribe. And thanks to the internet, like back in the day, if you had like some kind of obscure hobby, I don't know, like water ballooning with Czech colors or whatever, right? Something crazy as that is very niche. Back in the old days, you had a big problem just finding a group. But because you have the internet now, like the geography really doesn't matter. Like you can have some twisted small little group, but because it's online, you can reach like every person who loves that niche from all over the world, and you can create a community from that. And that's basically that idea I got for like niche writing as well. So if you write, let's say, a science fiction story, like you can go, like, science fiction is very general and you have a lot of people in that genre, but a lot of those people are just like casual readers, right? They're not diehard readers because science fiction is very general description. But when you go very niche within science fiction, you will always find like a hardcore audience, right? So space opera is a niche of science fiction, which deals exclusively with colonization in space, spaceships, space battles. And it is usually like soft science fiction, meaning that it's very easy on the science and it's more about the story and about the epic spectacle. But people who read that genre, that subgenre, are very passionate. And it's much smaller than science fiction, right? Because it's very niche. But they're so much more fervent and passionate about it that they read 7 or 10 books a week. Like, they're really, like, they're devouring it like a freaking Balrog from Lord of the Rings. And yeah, if you find those niche audience and it's something that you enjoy as well, you can really write something that makes a lot of good sales, even though the genre is pretty small, just because the base is so fervent.
So yeah, it's interesting that you're talking about that, about sales, because that's something we really haven't talked a lot about on the podcast yet. We haven't talked much about business. Stephen and I have mostly talked about, you know, our most recent podcast as of when we're recording this was with an editor friend of mine named Brett Stevens. And so we ended up talking a lot about editing. But one of the things that I wanted to get around to with him before we basically ran out of time was, you know, let me ask you this. As a writer, how important is that you know your target audience and that you find your tribe, as you say, or as this marketing guy says? How important is it that you find your tribe and know who you're writing for before you sit down to even write a word? Is that really like the main thing you should do as a writer?
Well, you see, like, there is no right way of being an author, right? Whenever someone tells you should do that and that, it's just like a principle or a suggestion. It always comes down to your goals. So I love writing. I really love storytelling. So I have that artist within me. But I also want to make money from it, right? I don't want to just create stories that no one is interested in. So what I do personally, I have like the artist in me and the business guy, and they both have to work together. So for example, if I think about some kind of story, I ponder whether that has any chance of getting like read. And then I think about, like, is this, like, it has to be a story that I want to tell. Like, I don't know, I don't write just because to make sales, right? If that was the case, I would just write romance, because romance authors, they make a crap load of money and they sell like high, like the best of them make 7 figures, and it's insane how much money they make, right? But I'm not interested in romance. Like, I don't like to read about romance in books, so I could never do that. That's why I picked fantasy and science fiction, because that's what I love in games and in books and in movies. And yeah, so it has to be, I think from my point of view, it has to be something that you enjoy. If you just write for the market and your heart is not in it, I mean, maybe you make a lot of sales, but is that really like something you enjoy doing, right? So it has to have that aspect of me loving it. But then when I really love that genre, I think about, okay, like, what kind of market is it? Like, when I think about a really cool cyborg story or something like that, right? Then I really think about, should I turn this into like a space opera story? Should I turn it like into a more post-apocalyptic story in Earth? Or should it be like cyberpunk or whatever, right? So once I have that story that I'm really enjoying, that I want to tell, then I really already think about like which target audience I could aim for. And then I basically merge it with my story and my interest. And then it really becomes a mix between like what I want to do and then whom I can present it to, right? Instead of having this crazy ass genre mix that uses every genre that is out there, but it is very hard to market.
Yeah, that in a way is kind of the problem with my first book, is that I threw everything but the kitchen sink at it. And I think maybe a lot of authors do that. You know, because my first book is kind of, it's a historical book, obviously, because that's what I write, is historical fiction. But historical romance, actually. But, you know, not really historical romance. That's not really true. There is romance in it, but it's not historical romance. But it's like a book about samurai. And I was thinking, you know, is this book a pastoral? Because half of the book involves a trip across Japan. Mm. But the other half is like a mystery. You know, it's basically solving a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's kind of a mistake that I think I made was, you know, making a book with multiple genres. Is that something that, you know, you struggled with as well when you were first started writing?
Absolutely. Like, I had no idea. I basically didn't. I knew that I wanted to make like sales from my books, right? Because actually, my goal was to become like a professional illustrator and author, preferably who does both. And but I was so clueless. Everything I learned up until then was just about storytelling, like intro, third act structure, character development, and all that jazz. But I didn't basically spend any time on market research or just understanding how self-publishing works and how to appeal to different crowds. And I do that nowadays. And the truth is, like, even if you say, I don't know, you want to write like a crime thriller or something, right? Like, even if you have that genre, there's so much you can do within that, right? It's just a very basic container where you have to have some basic tropes, but within that genre or subgenre, there's just so much you can do. Like, you can have, basically, it's still like, it's not even that restrictive because you can do basically anything within those tropes, like the characters, the setting, and all that jazz. So for me, it's actually a blessing. Because if somebody tell me, like, you can write whatever you want and it can have 10 genres within, like, that would be just creative overkill. Like, I would create, like, some kind of stream of consciousness story that is just, like, an acid trip or something like that, right? Because I have no, like, my inspiration would just go wild. And as soon as I have, like, some kind of restriction, then it works much better for me because I know, so I can do it in this way, in this way. And for me, that's pretty helpful, actually.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you mentioned that because that's kind of a philosophy that I've sort of been thinking about recently. Because I'm not going to get into why I've been thinking about, you know, like writing techniques and things like that. But I was kind of thinking, what happens when you put barriers up? Because we're always taught as artists, don't limit yourself. Don't put up artificial barriers, et cetera, et cetera. But what happens when you do start putting them up? What happens whenever you say, okay, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do that? That kind of creates almost writing from, in the same way that an artist, maybe a visual artist would say, okay, I need to utilize negative space as well, because I can't just have drawing everywhere on the piece of paper and have it look meaningful, right? Because if you draw a picture of, a giraffe on the African plain, you're going to need negative space. You're going to need white space. You're going to need things that just, you're going to need room, right? Otherwise, people are not going to see giraffe on the African plain. They're going to see big old mess, right? Excuse me. So is that kind of the same way? Is that kind of what you're talking about along those same lines?
Well, yeah, it's basically about a balance, right? So if everything is possible, I think, and I don't think it's just me. A lot of my creative friends told me something similar. Like, if there's unlimited freedom when it comes to what you want to work, then it can be, it can really strangely restrict you because you're just overwhelmed. Like, you don't know where to start and what to do. And as soon as you have, obviously, that some kind of restriction, but that must be obviously free of choice, like not like a governmental restriction or something like that. Just something like because your client, I don't know, your client wants something like in that corner and or your client hates blue, so use everything but blue. Like if it's anything like that, your mind becomes more focused and you still have so much opportunity and potential, but then you have to focus, okay, so I have to go more in that direction, And like I said before, some kind of balance where you have to say, I have to work within those parameters, it's so much better because there's still so much you can do, but at least you have a direction where you can go to. And for me, that's super helpful and it helps me create like more work and even like better work, like I said before, like otherwise it would be just like a creative mess and everything, like it would just try everything at once, and that would be a pain for any observer or reader.
Yeah, I think that's why I loved that art, that most recent blog that you wrote so much, because it really, I mean, I've been, and I've talked about this on other podcasts, I've been writing for companies, you know, doing marketing, writing their websites, or, you know, any sort of marketing material. And so, but more recently, I've been, you know, wanting to sit down and start writing. I have been writing more fiction. And, you know, when it comes to thinking about a novel, you know, I was all over the place. I wanted to do so many different things. And, you know, just reading that article made me realize, you know, that, you know, I just need to find a focus. And, you know, as soon as I did that, I've been, you know, able to bring in some of those other things that I was wanting to do and really bring everything together and start to actually, you know, map out what I really want to write.
Yeah. And like I said, even if you have a specific genre in mind, there's still so much you can do. Like so many, like, you know, like in my story, like the Crystal Crusade, I have video game elements from Japan, but then it plays in Colorado in a trailer park, which is part of my life experience because I used to go to high school in Colorado in the US and I lived in a trailer park. So it's actually the same trailer park that's part of the story, right? Obviously, I've changed names because I don't want to get sued from my host family if they're still out there. But no, this was aimed for like a gaming crowd, like some call it lit RPG. But even with that kind of focus and the science fiction aspect, like there's so much variety in things I can do with it, right? I use my own personal experience. I use like some kind of philosophy that I learned in German school. I use like basically a Japanese styled virtual reality game. And like there's so many different cultural differences, like styles and inspirations in that story, so that it still feels different than another story in that subgenre, right? Because you, as a creative, you can mix everything together while still fitting like a specific trope or so. So it's just, you know, like instead of having 5 million options, I have like 1 million options, right? And that's still a lot of options.
Right, and it's just, it really helps you focus, you know, focus your own writing, but then also helps the reader kind of, you know, that really does come across when you have such a focused story and you really drilled it down well.
Yeah, and like you can always, like I'm not saying you can always mix genres, right? There's now paranormal space opera, which is usually like the opposite, because space opera is supposed to be like based on science, even if it's like loose. But paranormal, now you see that with vampires, werewolves, and spaceships, right? And you have very strange combinations nowadays. And that can work as well, right? Like, I think if you mix like two genres, that can work very well because you take the best of two worlds. But as soon as you have like maybe like three, four, five, maybe it becomes like a mess where it's unclear whom you're writing for. But again, like there's still like, even with a sub niche, there's so much you can do, and it defines, like it really helps you focus your story and your work. And I never really feel restricted no matter which subgenre I write in, because there's so much I can take from my personal experience, from my journeys, from my travels, from the books that I read, from the video games that I play. It's still, that's what I love about it. There's still so much you can do.
So I guess I was just going to totally switch gears here if you have a question like on that subject.
Oh no, I was going to switch gears as well because I wanted to talk about the fact that Mars is basically our first bilingual author, and I wanted to talk
a little bit about foreign language. Oh, I love this topic.
Yeah, Stephen and I are both learning foreign languages. Stephen's learning Dutch, I'm learning Hungarian. Jan Pot, Hozhvoj, everybody, if you're doing well this afternoon. But yeah, I want to ask you this, Mars. Do you write in English or do you write in German and translate into English? And when you're writing, do you think in English?
Yeah, so I write in English and I think in English. I don't have as much experience talking in English because I live in Berlin, Germany. But and because I'm working basically my creative cave, which is like a studio in the center of Berlin. And usually, you know, like I'm an introvert, so there's a lot of silent time between me and my Mac. So my written English is so much better because I write in English every single day. Like, you know, obviously all the books, then the client emails, like every, because I would say like 99% of my clients are like English speakers. So every single email is in English as well. Like if you make a contract, if you an agreement, whatever. It has become actually so intense that I'm no, and that I'm not doing deliberately. That's like an unconscious choice. But I'm actually like replying to my mother in English. And she's like, and she does speak like her English is not like terrible, but it's not really good either. And she's like, why do you speak English to me? Like, is that like, you know, like she's getting mad about that, but it just happens because I do everything else in English.
Yeah, so let me ask you, is that a hard skill to acquire? Because, like, I speak French fairly fluently. I mean, I could live in France and function. Mm-hmm. But is that a hard skill to acquire? Where you go from thinking in your native language that you grew up thinking in, to thinking in a foreign language, because I, even whenever I speak French, or speak with some of my French friends on Discord and things like that, and on gaming Discords, I think in English and then translate into French. Is that really a hard thing to do, to think in a foreign language?
I guess it has to do with how foreign that language is, right? So in terms of English is very close to, it's a Germanic language. And because I learned Spanish and French in school, and English has a lot of French, right? In terms of, basically half the language is Latin-based, right? So harmony, government, society, science, those are all basically Latin words. So I spoke pretty decent French back then, and my German. So English is not as hard as some other language. But when it comes down to writing, especially when you're writing a book, where you not only have to worry about grammar, but you have to worry about, you know, like characters, dialogue, story structure, themes, subtext, and all that jazz. When you have to worry about so many things, that can become pretty overwhelming. But because I did it for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now, and I had my blog before that, I just conditioned myself to think in English as well. So whenever I think a story, and I think a lot about stories, like this is what I'm actually doing. When I'm walking outside, I usually have like a run in the park, and I'm always thinking in stories about any kind of stories, and they're always in English. And I condition myself to do that so that when I write, it becomes more natural, right? I think there's like a disconnect if you think in your native language and then you translate into your target language when you talk. But there's always a delay and a disconnection. And I think if you really want to be fluent in that language, in both writing and speaking, you wanna think in that language as well.
That's something I'm definitely working on right now, even though, you know, with Dutch, it's not going to be as useful for me as it is obviously for you. But that's definitely something I've been kind of fascinated with, the idea of and wanting to explore that.
Yeah. So what you want to do, like if you're really into it, is that you surround yourself obviously with that language, which in English is pretty easy, especially if you're online, because everything I watch and listen to is basically English, except for some German news maybe. But yeah, at some stage, right, you become so accustomed to that language that, like, when you hear a word, like more complicated words, that I know what it means, I know how to use it, but I cannot translate it to you in German.
Yeah, no, and that's something that really kind of you know, it was actually amazing to me, and I guess this is kind of a little off that topic, but when I was writing marketing material, marketing websites or whatever, I never thought that I could ever do that in a foreign language, simply because, you're right, you know, when I hear a complex English word, you know, I might not even fully understand the meaning of that word, but I get it. I understand the feeling behind that word. I understand, certain things, you know, how to use it, even if I really don't understand. You know, I don't know the literal definition. But it was amazing to me as soon as I started learning Dutch that I was sort of, you know, not as well as I do in English, of course, but even very early on, I was picking up on some of these, you know, on some of these things, on some of the, you know, the emotion behind the words, on, you know, how you use them or how I would use them differently if I were writing a different kind of website. And it was amazing to me how early on I realized that. And it made me realize that writing isn't so much about, you know, words and grammar. It's a lot about people.
Yeah. And basically it's just like, no, not just, it's like, especially when you write like a story in America, like the way people speak and what kind of topics they would pick, right? That is something that is like the cultural part of a language. So you can perfectly, especially if you write, you can have like a really good English, but if you don't understand, like, for example, the cultural aspect, that it will always sound like stilted, right? And real quick, when I said that I even think in English with all my stories, one reason why that is effective is that you start, it becomes more natural the way people interact when you write about them. Because when you always translate, right, like my mother's the best example. She tells me, like, she always, even when she speaks English, she thinks in German. And the problem with that is she actually had like, and she's still an artist. She had actually an exhibition in New York in the United Nations Plaza, right? The German embassy. So what happens then is like she has like a speech and she's in English, but she's thinking in German. So she's using like German idioms and sayings, but translating them into English, and no one understands what she's talking about.
Yeah, that's something that I've kind of sort of learned a little bit about in Hungarian, because Hungarian doesn't have gendered pronouns. It doesn't have the words he and she, but they just use the word cha, and it just means he or she. So you kind of have to know what they're talking about. That's something that it gives me a new perspective on words, you know, or like agglutination is something that's big in Hungarian. They just take smaller words and string them together and create larger words. Like I can't even say their word for goodbye yet. I'm just at this point, I'm just using the slang term "vislak" for goodbye in Hungarian. And so it's like, you know, it's a great way, I think, of learning to think about words and etymology and things like that, is just learning a foreign language, you know?
Yeah. And real quick, it has to do, I mean, with English, obviously, because of the dominance of the American culture and video games and movies and series and what have you, it's much easier to get that American style, like the way people talk to each other, right? And to get all the colloquialism and the slang and stuff like that. And when you learn like a language like Hungarian, like, it's much harder because there's just not enough stuff out there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, like, I would love to find something like a bilingual book that is, or a, you know, a bilinear book or something like that that is Hungarian and English. But right now I'm just using Duolingo to learn Hungarian. And I've also been to that, what is it, Benny's site? Fluent in 3 months. Yeah, I've been there, and I love his site too. I wanted to talk about that earlier when Stephen was talking about it, but yeah, I really enjoy his site. And, you know, if I weren't learning Hungarian, I'd be learning something like Irish because it's just so beautiful. But
oh,
yeah.
It's an awesome language.
Yeah. I mean, so let me ask you, Mars, do you plan to write anything in German in the future? And, like, how popular are American stories or English stories to German readers? Like, do German readers prefer to read in German, or does it really matter?
Well, I know from my UK and US friends who are self-publishers as well, that their number one foreign speaking market where they sell their English books to is actually Germany, or I should say the German speaking market, which people forget. I mean, German is the most spoken language in Europe officially, right? Because you have Germany, which is 80 million people, then you have Switzerland, which is like 7 million people, and then you have Austria, which is similar. So in total, you have and then you have Belgium, and the Netherlands, where they always speak pretty good German. So you have about 110 million German speakers in the European Union. And German speakers are also pretty good at English. So you do make sales in Germany. And in Germany, the German-speaking world is one of the biggest book markets in the world. Like Germans, I have to check back on that, but I want to believe that actually the second most written articles on Wikipedia are in German.
I think that might be true, actually, because I do know that I sell pretty well in Germany. About half of my sales come from overseas, and a lot of them are German sales as well. And, you know, I just kind of assumed that, you know, maybe Germans just like to read, or, you know, maybe it's expats living in Germany that wanted to read it, because I know Germany has a lot of American expats there.
Yeah.
But British people like to go to Germany as well.
Yeah, here's the fun thing. So it's a huge book market. It's the biggest one in Europe by far. Germans, I think, belong to the group that read the most books in terms of like all cultures and nations. So it's a huge market. And another thing is that most of the books, because I went to like a Berlin-based like publishing event, and like there's always like a bias against America, right? Because like the culture is taking over and everything is American. We should read more like German books written by German authors. But then the guy said, like, and he works for like a publisher, he said like, over 70% of all the books available in German are American or British books. So, right, from 100 books, 70% come from the UK and the US, and they're translated into German. So they're basically like, Germans read more American books in English than they read German books written by German authors.
Yeah, wow, that's impressive. There's something going on Gab right now, and it is, we have had a kind of an influx of German speakers, and my timeline is just full of German speakers, and I've been translating things out of German because Gab will allow you to do that. Has there been like a recent free speech crackdown in Germany recently on social media? Because it seems like that's what people have done, because there are a lot of German speakers on Gab now.
If I'm not mistaken, actually, I think Andrew Torba actually sent out that Germany is the number one market now on Gab. It surpassed the U.S.
Wow. Well, incredible justice minister. That's what we call him. German has like a beautiful quote that really is on my wavelength when he said, you know, freedom of speech is good, but it has to have its limits. And obviously that was sarcasm.
Yeah, I assumed that was sarcasm. But yeah, I was like, I was just thinking, you know, like, because I know that the German government has been pressuring like Facebook to censor what they call hate speech. So like, what is the mood among Germans for that? Is it like, are Germans really just that cucked? I mean, do they want to, you know, say, hey, I'll give up, you know, my ability to criticize, you know, a bunch of rapists coming into our country? You know, so that I don't offend anyone. Is that really the mood in Germany, or are we getting a misrepresentation of Germany through media?
Like I said, like the justice minister that I just quoted, he made that, like he wrote that law, or at least the, how do you call that, like the basic form of it. And he is actually the guy who's pushing for that basically limited free speech on social media. What he basically wants to do is that obviously if you say something bad about politically incorrect topics like immigrants or, I don't know, free speech or anything like that, then you have that word as well, like it's considered hate speech, right? And some political parties are really pushing that narrative that you cannot, like, if especially when it comes to immigrants or refugees, that you cannot say that kind of stuff because it's inciting hatred, and you cannot say it against politicians, right? We actually had a big thing going on where someone said like that politician should be hanged, right? Hung. And that like he had to pay like a fine and almost went to prison for that. And that's pretty scary because that doesn't feel like a modern Western democratic country, more like some kind of like a Middle Eastern regime. And there's a lot of pushback, right? So it's not like it's just like all 80 million people in Germany are for that. It's a really big pushback from a lot of people. And it's almost, I don't know the exact ratio, but a lot of people are afraid of that. And they really openly declare their concerns because it is dangerous. Because especially with our history with Hitler and like East Germany and the regime, a socialist regime, right? We have a lot of speech control in the past. And it just boggles my mind. Like I cannot understand how with that kind of history that you're still pushing, that you still think that restricting language is a good idea, right? Because it never amounts to anything good. It will always get more limited, right? In the future, you may not be able to openly criticize a political party if you're using curse words or whatever, right? Anything can come. And I hope the pushback increases. And yeah, I just, whenever I talk in public or so, I always, I'm always pushing against that because I hate it. Like it's just, it's always used in terms of like, in terms of harmony and the greater good, right? Like, oh, we're not restricting language. We just want to ensure that our language becomes more harmonious and that it becomes respectful of different people. Like they always have that positive framing. But like, if you know the history, you know that's just like a setup for really limiting your freedom.
Yeah, and the question I was going to ask earlier is somewhat related, but we, and it was actually one that Ever asked, I know, in his author interview, but I kind of liked your perspective on it, so I kind of wanted to just mention it here, and it was what you had said on the idea of cultural appropriation in writing.
You want to hear my thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was, you know, I kind of like what you had said about it in the interview, because it was very, I mean, we've kind of heard a number of different views on it now. We try to ask a lot of the authors we interview with, and you know, I love your more cavalier attitude, and it probably comes from being a science fiction writer, about, you know, it's not really something you have to, you know, the research and whatnot. It's more of a, you know, you don't always have to be culturally accurate.
Yeah. So here's something interesting, and it seems like a paradox. Even though we have those ideas about like the restriction of language on social media, like when it comes to universities or colleges, like we don't have the craze that you have in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Like people, like even like in, I would say, a fairly left-leaning city like Berlin. Like if you dress up for Halloween or celebrate like an Indian or whatever, like no one's going to say anything. We don't have that idea of cultural appropriation. I mostly only know now from the US and the UK. And I guess some people who really research that topic know it in Germany, but most people, even like on the left, found it absolutely ridiculous because, it's just, I mean, the idea that you're taking something from a different culture is basically world history 101, right? Like if you look at Italians, right? They're famous for pasta, like spaghetti, macaroni, and what have you. But they didn't invent pasta, right? That most people say like the Chinese did it, but they had a different kind of noodles. So would you say that the Italians culturally appropriated noodles from the Chinese? What an insane concept, right? It's just natural that this is actually the best part of humanity, that you take something from a different culture and you change it or you improve it or you mix it with something else. I mean, that's basically how innovation happens, right? I mean, I don't, like when people speak, I just don't understand which direction. Are they going for like direction where like the cultures are so separate and there's no overlap and everything should be like really pure and like segregated. I mean, I mean, that's, they always sound to me like basically almost like nationalist, even though they want to be the complete opposite, but the way they just talk.
Yeah, it's okay.
I was just going to say, you know, it's like cultural appropriation is a bullshit concept because there's no such thing as cultural appropriation. There's only culture. And like, if you think about, I don't know what Berlin is like as far as your, you know, where you can go to eat and things like that. But in central Texas, it's like, you know, there are German speaking people in Texas and there are Czech speaking people, and you can get German food and German sausage. And, you know, we celebrate things like Oktoberfest.
Everett, please, before you continue, please stop culturally appropriating my bratwurst.
Fuck you. I love bratwurst, goddammit, and I love
I don't want a Texas bratwurst, I want a German bratwurst only.
We have German bratwurst, goddammit, but we put jalapenos in it because that is how culture works.
No, let's finish this conversation right now. This is just...
Excuse me, but no. No, we are... We took your goddamn bratwurst and put jalapenos in it. Now it's better.
That's Texas bratwurst.
And we don't even call it bratwurst, Van. We call it brats.
Oh my god.
And we have Hefeweizen and we have good
Texas Hefeweizen. Is doomed.
Oh yeah.
Your culture is doomed. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, that's awesome. I mean, but this is what happens, right? I mean, you take like a dish, like especially you take something, you know, like potatoes, like Germans are famous for like for their potatoes, but the potatoes come like from South America, right? So potatoes, they have no history in Europe. We imported them and then they became like a national like dish almost, and Germans didn't invent soccer, but we're pretty good at it and we imported it. So this is like what happens. You import something and then based on your culture or your background, you change it. You either improve it or you make it different. And that's a good thing. I mean, that's like fostering like a positive relationship with another culture. Because if you're changing like a bratwurst or something, right? It's not because you hate it. It's because you want to do something else with it and try a new flavor. And that's a good thing. And I don't know. I know where they're coming from the ideology when they say, oh, it must be separated, because they always talk about that exploitation and big imperialists that taking a culture. And I see like the origins of that. But it just, I mean, they have such a restrictive view and it's really like hostile towards any change or innovation. And I don't even know how it can go on in the US, because you are a melting pot, right? Like you're the prime example of different cultures working together. And it, I mean, like cultural appropriation is like, basically it's anti-American.
Well, think of it this way. The best food in the world is places that either did a lot of trading with other people, like port cities. Or places that got conquered a lot, or places that did a lot of conquering. Like, I mean, think about Texas. I mean, when you think of Texas food, you think of barbecue. You know, it's like, and when I talk to my European friends, like people on Discord and things like that, they ask us like about Texas food, and they say, well, you know, because here's the thing, Texas barbecue is different than South Carolina barbecue. We cook differently. We use different techniques. We use different spices. You know, like nobody cooks a bratwurst, or not a bratwurst, a brisket like Texans do. It's a different kind of cooking. And it's like the Indians had the technique, the fire. You know, the Spanish had the pig, or sometimes the cattle. The Germans had some of the food as well. And you mix all these things together, and then you get this kind of Texas barbecue, which is different than South Carolina barbecue, which was heavily influenced by the French. Or the same thing with Louisiana barbecue. You know, like Cajun food is its own food. Texas food is actually a thing. We have a type of food called Tex-Mex.
Yeah, I know that.
And it's you know, nobody says let's go get some Scottish tonight.
True. Yeah, and coming back to that.
Go ahead.
So when like going back like to storytelling and writing characters and stuff like that. Like, or even art, like my art is basically a mix between like Franco-Belgium, like old European style mixed with like Japanese anime, manga a little bit. And then like Jamie Hewlett, who's like the creator, like the comic creator of Gorillaz, who made Tank Girl, right? It's like a mix of like different artists coming from different parts of the world. And that's how you create something new and exciting. And when you write stories, right, like the idea that because I'm a white man from Germany, I can only write about white men in Germany, it's just ridiculous, right? Like an author or creator should be able to do whatever he wants. And like, for example, in all my books, I don't have a single main German character. They're always, American or coming from someplace else. And I'm writing about cultures or countries that I've never even been to. But because I want to write about that, because I have friends who maybe come from that those countries, I want to try different stuff. And, you know, when I write about America, I'm not American. I lived there like for 1.5 years, but I love that culture. I love that mentality, and I love telling stories taking place there. And does it mean because like I'm a foreigner, like am I culturally appropriating the US? I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's lunacy.
Well, it's like I've written 2 books set in Japan. I've been there, but I don't know that much about it. You know, I wouldn't pretend to know that much about it. I researched Japan and Sengoku period as a historian would do it. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's just every great once in a while I'll get an email that says something like, you know, I really kind of am offended by the fact that you, a white American, a white American, are writing about Japan. You know, you shouldn't be doing that. This is my culture. You go write about your own. And I'm like, go kill yourself.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's that I, because we Germans take basically everything that you invent, the good and the bad stuff. So I hope we don't, but I think we will be like copying those kind of people as well and that kind of mentality. I think maybe like in 3 or 4 years in Germany, we'll have the same crazy discussions that you do like in universities, where just having a different opinion results in having you banned from speaking or crazy stuff like that, right?
No, it's ridiculous. I, you know, I really hope we break that. I mean, even Richard Dawkins.
I read that.
He couldn't even speak at Berkeley. Like, even Richard Dawkins can't speak at Berkeley. So it's ridiculous.
Bill Maher got kicked out of Berkeley as well. And Milo had a bunch of riots there whenever. Milo Yiannopoulos had a bunch of riots.
Yeah, but you expect Milo. You don't expect Bill Maher to get picked to get banned for speaking at Berkeley. It's so ridiculous.
Well, to really like connect, you know, like closing a loop here, like everything that's happening, especially like in US or like I should say North American universities, because it's happening in Canada as well. It really reminds me of what my parents told about their upbringing, because when they went to university or before they went to university or school, you actually have like classes where you learn to be politically correct. They didn't call it political correctness back then, but it's what it was. Like how to be basically, like there's the mainstream political thought, and basically you learn how to cater towards that, right? So how to be in line, how to use correct language. And it's something that, like back then, you had, like the German, the Eastern German was quite different from the Western German because they had a lot of invented words or like odd word combinations. Like everything had like a military aspect because they were preparing for war against the American imperialist, right? So like you didn't go to like a little beverage shop. You went like to the beverage outpost. Like that's where you were calling it, right? Or the supermarket is like a supply depot. That's what a lot of people call the supermarket, right? So, and you had to use that language, right? If you just said like supermarket, people like, ah, oh, that's not like the correct language. So there was really already like a controlling of language, and you actually had to take courses to use the correct language and the right thinking. And you have that same stuff, obviously with a different topics, but you have basically the same mechanics now in universities where you have to go to political correct courses, right? Sensitivity class, like diverse sensitivity or whatever you call them. And it's basically, it's the same methodology.
That is absolutely fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah. Everything that you have, we had in the East Germany, exactly the same, just obviously the topics are different. Methodology is the same, like as well, like back then words were also considered weapons. That's why it had to be restricted. And you had like the prime minister, I guess that's what you call him in English, like from East Germany said, like a revolutionary community has to use a revolutionary language. And there were words that you couldn't use because they were imperialistic, like American imperialistic. Like you couldn't use like English words because they were propagating American imperialism and stuff like that, right? And you have pretty similar discussions now in university as well, where you cannot say that because I guess it's white supremacy or whatever you call it. So that's interesting to see just history repeating itself in a completely different culture.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's I guess it's they approach it and they pretend to be nicer about it, make it, you know, something fantastic, but...
Well, it's purchasing. It's people saying, let's do this to protect this little culture here. Let's not say anything naughty about these people over here because it might hurt them, it might do something bad, and we know where, you know, we know where hate ends up. It ends up with, you know, Hitler and the 6 million and all that stuff. And, you know, that's the thinking that these SJW types have is, you know, if we allow bad words, we allow criticism of things that are, you know, in a particular little box that we draw our line around.
The major problem is
always protected. So, you're not allowed to criticize it.
Yeah. And the problem is just obviously always the hypocrisy, right? When they talked in Soviet Germany, about, like American imperialism, right? Like imperialism implying that you have a big country invading and dominating another smaller country. I mean, that was basically...
Like they forgot the Russian Empire.
Or yeah, the Soviet Empire, that was all they did. Invading and dominating, colonizing smaller countries. Like that's the entire modus operandi. Like that's how they worked. But you see that this is the danger of ideology, that once you really are... like addicted to a certain ideology, you don't see the reality or the facts anymore. You just see like everything according to your ideology, and you blend out anything that opposes your worldview, which obviously results in huge hypocrisy. Because when you do it, it's okay. When the others do it, it's not okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't have any more. Do you have any more, Stephen?
No, I'm tired now.
Yeah, it is getting early. We are, since Mars is in Berlin, we are recording. It is 5 a.m. here in Texas.
Oh, holy crap.
At the moment. Yeah, but that's okay. I'm a night owl. I stay up anyway.
It's not the first time we've done this.
Mm. Yeah, we sometimes do like marathon podcast recording where we just go 3 podcasts in a row all night long. But yeah, we thank you, Mars, for being with us here. We're going to wrap it up here. Mm-hmm. So yeah, thanks for joining us, Mars. We really appreciate it. Love talking to you. Love having you on the podcast. You're welcome back anytime you want. And dude,
I was just going to say, we'll include his books in the on the site in the description and all that for the links to Amazon.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so if you're listening on iTunes or any of the other methods, I think we're talking, Steve and I are talking about putting this up on YouTube as well, or we've kind of been noodling around with that idea. So, you know, if you're listening on iTunes or whatever, rate us, leave us a comment. We love hearing from you guys. You can email us at podcast@uprisingview.com. The website, every Monday we have a new short story up. It's uprisingview.com. Tuesdays are op-eds. Wednesdays are interviews. Thursdays are podcasts. And Fridays are the link roundup. So we give you a break on the weekends. So thank you guys for being with us. Thank you guys for listening to us. Thank you again, Mars, for joining us. And I will say, whenever I have my book out, I like you enough now that I'm going to have you do my book cover for me whenever I put my book out.
Oh, wow.
About the Renaissance.
Yeah, just so like set me new ideas customer. And stuff like that. And thank you guys for having me on. It was really a pleasure, like, to talk to you and exchange ideas and stuff like that. I love that.
Yeah, it's been really great having you on, Mars, and you're welcome back anytime you want to come on or promote a book. We'll definitely help you out there. So, thank you guys for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Again, if you liked us, podcast@uprisingview.com. The website is uprisingview.com. For Stephen Willis, I am Everett Foster. Take it easy, guys. Peace, love.